Hello, and welcome to Is Able, the radio show about possibility, where we look at what a person with disabilities can do rather than what they cannot do. Hello, this is Dr. Steve Nurse, and this is our series on the Vietnam War, or if they say in Vietnam, the American War in Vietnam. And so we're looking at personal stories. We're looking at a whole variety of things. And so today I've got another one of the people that I went to school with and knew his mom and dad, and his name is Mike Allen, and Mike was a Vietnam vet, and he was there from 68 to 70. Is that correct, Mike?
1969 and 70. I joined in 68, and I served in Vietnam September of 69 through September of 1970.
And so Mike and I go way back, and we also know the other people that Lloyd Webster, who was we did an interview with, and Jim McFarland, who lives up in Alaska now, and we just go ahead, Mike.
Those guys were a couple years older than me in school,
right?
And those guys who graduated from high school in 64, 65, 66, they had a many of them had it pretty bad over there. Those were horrible years in Vietnam.
And that was a big, you know, they were there in that, the big Tet Offensive in 68. And,
that's the crescendo.
Yeah. And, you know, I'm sure we both know people that have done very well, have come out of the war and done okay and, got back to life. But, and some that from our school that didn't do well. And, we need to look at things like also PTSD that we didn't look at in World War II, and things like Agent Orange, which is affecting people today and in Vietnam all over. So, well, tell me, Mike, when you you did your basic training where?
San Diego at the Marine Corps Recruit Depot.
Okay, and you enlisted, correct?
Right. I graduated Ellensburg High School in June of 68. I went to Central Washington State College that fall and joined the Marine Corps in December. But then I went winter quarter to Central before I had to go to San Diego. So I went to San Diego in March of 68 and went all through my schools. And then I was in Vietnam by September of 1969.
I think I would have gone to San Diego at that time just to get out of the weather in Ellensburg.
We had
some pretty cold winters there.
Yeah, it was warm, you know, we didn't get to enjoy any of the nice things of San Diego, unfortunately.
That's right. You weren't there as a tourist, you know, to see all those things on the on the TV. Welcome to San Diego, you know. And
yeah.
Everything is beautiful, but when you landed in Vietnam, and I've always said it's like just taking these, you know, farm kids and these people out of cities and taking these 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old kids, and I still call them kids, and just kind of dumping them in a jungle thousands of miles away. What was your first reaction when you landed in Vietnam?
Well, I was going to say something when we got started, you know. Growing up in Ellensburg, a lot of our context was World War II, and our father, you know, guys our father's age and older guys who had been in World War II. So I kind of, because it was in Asia, I kind of went in with World War II movies in my mind.
Audie Murphy, you know.
I was actually in an amphibious landing, but it wasn't. It wasn't anything like the sands of Iwo Jima, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's probably a good thing.
yeah.
But I think your point is well taken. You know, during World War II, My dad worked for King County Dairymen's Association down there, you know, where they had the old dairy gold plant. And
sure.
He was not called up for duty in World War II because he was the powdered milk maker there at the KCDA.
Yeah, yeah.
So they needed powdered milk. That was one of those things. But he also, I still have the armband. He had an armband that was National Defense armband. He was supposed to go around, when they would have blackouts, he would go around and let people know if they had their...
Jimmy Stewart in It's a Wonderful Life.
Yeah. That's a good point.
We grew up around those World War II guys. I don't think we knew what a huge influence it was. And, you know, I'm talking about PTSD and all of that. I mean, geez, some of those guys in that little town had these horrible experiences in World War II, and they came home and they went to work, you know. And
yeah.
They surrounded us. And so that was part of our...
Go ahead. I'm sorry. I jumped in there.
Okay. Anyway, that was part of our mentality and that sense of duty too, and just the tradition that you join the military and that sort of thing. We grew up around that.
And I think when I was a kid, we played Army. That was the thing we did, I had more non-lethal weapons than most other kids. You know, we had cap guns, and I even had a thing that had batteries in it that was like a machine gun, you know, it was different, but you know, you really didn't hear, you saw the new newsreels and stuff, but you really didn't hear of people talking about their experience. I know, you know, yeah. Even the large families, you know, the Schneblies and the Kearns and, they, most of them had, you know, family members that they lost in World War II, but, it was a different thing. And is this fair to say you're a historian, you've written a history book. Is that thing still for sale?
Oh yeah.
Good.
Yeah, we're going 20th anniversary edition of the Patriots History of the United States.
Good. Well, maybe I can get a signed copy of that or something sometime for
you betcha.
And remember, that's the 20th anniversary edition of that book. Buy one now. But so tell me, so you had an amphibious landing in Vietnam, huh?
Well, it was not a contested landing, but we did. I was in an amphibious brigade, and so we went to shore on these landing boats, and there to greet us were kids. The kids in Vietnam were ubiquitous wherever there were soldiers. The kids showed up to sell you various products, and they were curious, and so so that was my action. We hit the beach, and the kids tried to sell us drugs and cigarettes and booze and whatever else they had, you know.
Wow, all the good things. It is too bad. You know, maybe 50 years from now, there's that old Woody Allen movie, Sleeper. Remember that one? And where he says they're getting him out of a coma, and all the surgeons are smoking, and they're saying the reason that people died so early was they didn't eat enough red meat or smoke enough. You know?
yeah, I remember.
That was a problem there. So, so then were you assigned to a base or a...
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I was in the artillery, Steve. So I was on what were called fire support bases in Vietnam. And fire support base isn't the rear, and it's not the bush. Fire support bases were in the bush. They provided artillery support for grunts, infantry men, but they were surrounded by barbed wire and claymore mines and all kinds of security. And so it's kind of, people say, well, were you in combat in Vietnam? And I was in between. I was not in the rear. I was not a grunt. I was on a fire support base, which means the only the only action we saw was what were called incoming rounds or incoming.
Uh-huh.
And so that was...
Mortars, is that what you're talking about, mortars or rockets or...
Yeah.
Okay.
And, uh-huh. Or what the VC called lob, or what we call lob bombs, because the VC would... They'd retrieve some of our ordnance that had not exploded and then send it back. They literally they knew how to dig a hole and put like powder in the hole, and then they could send one of your own unexploded rounds back at you. Those were called lob bombs.
And I also remember those, there were the bombs. One of the other vets was telling me about them, but they would find an unexploded, bullet. And would put it in a little pipe and then put a little nail underneath it and bury them in the ground. So if you stepped on them, that it would, shoot up through your foot. And go ahead.
They recycled.
Right.
The Viet Cong recycled.
Yes, that's right.
Our ordnance.
That's right. You couldn't just buy that stuff at Costco. You had to actually get it, find it out there someplace. I actually had a dog that was, this is a little off subject, but I had a service dog that was trained originally as a bomb sniffing dog at the airport.
Wow.
But my dog was too friendly, and when they were training him, he retrieved a bomb, and so that is not a good, not a good thing to do. You know, here, throw it again, So, so you were out there. So basically, if I understand what you're saying, is this support base, you had these big cannons, and
howitzers, 105 millimeter howitzers and 155 millimeter howitzers. And we supported the grunts. We supported the Marines who left the wire. They went outside the wire every night. And they did patrols and ambushes and listening posts. And then if they got into firefights, then we would support them. We also supported operations.
So you would shoot the shells out in front of them to try and get the NVA, or?
Yeah. They'd call in coordinates on a map where the enemy was, and then we would shoot try to fire our artillery into the enemy. And then there was a railroad. We were up north near the demilitarized zone. There was a railroad up there too that was real important. One of our jobs was to protect the railroad, because the BC were always blowing. They were always blowing up the railroad, And so that's what I did.
Yeah. I know.
I did that for 12 months. But I had two different outfits. I was in the 9th Marine Amphibious Brigade, which was a separate outfit, and then I eventually ended up with the 1st Marine Division in Vietnam.
Yeah, it's and I know. Were there lots of helicopters in and out of your base all the time too?
Yeah, we had an LZ, and most of our communications and stuff that had to happen fast came in and out of that LZ. And every Sunday, a preacher showed up on the LZ in the chopper and did a little religious service. Then went back on the chopper and went to another LZ and did a religious service.
I just learned that those were, the chaplains and the ministers that were there were called the sky pilots.
Huh.
Did you hear that from Eric Burden and the Animals has
The exact right date, 66, 67, sky pilot.
Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, and that's what they were. They were the chaplains, and how high can you fly? Can you get yourself all the way to heaven or not? I'm not betting on that right now. But so did you know any other folks that were from Ellensburg there when you were in country?
There were some friends of mine who were over there, who I was in touch with. Postcards and letters and that sort of thing. But I actually ran into Bob McClure. I don't know if you remember Bob McClure.
I do, yeah.
He lived by Ellensburg High School, and he and I, we were both in the artillery, and I ran into Bob on Hill 55 in Vietnam in the spring of 1970. And we were stationed there for a couple weeks together, which was pretty cool.
And now when you came back, did you come back to Ellensburg when you came back to the United States? Or did you?
You bet. I was never so glad to be in Ellensburg in my life. And I came right back there and I started up at Central. I went back to college in the fall of 1970 because Nixon had been elected and he was pulling troops out of Vietnam and all of us got out early. If you had time to go on your hitch in 1970, if you had time to go on your hitch, there was a good chance you could get out early.
Wow.
And so many of us didn't do our full enlistment tour. We just did training, 12 months in Vietnam, came home, honorable discharge, and back home.
And so when you came back to Ellensburg, how were you treated?
You know, Central wasn't bad, Stephen. You were there, too, at that time. Central was full, basically, I mean, it's full to the brim, 8,000-9,000 students, probably.
Right.
And a lot of them were vets. A lot of them were Vietnam vets, and a lot of them were students who were trying to, you know, avoid the draft and going into the Vietnam War and were opposed to the Vietnam War. But, you know, besides the usual aggravations and, you know, and left-wing stuff, I thought everybody got along pretty good.
Yeah, I thought so, too. No, my mom for a long time ran the.
She was my advisor. She helped me with my GI Bill, and she counseled a lot of the Vietnam veterans there. Oh yeah, we love Mrs. Nurse.
And she took that job very seriously. She really did. And
and it was a big job because she had a lot of veterans.
Yeah, she worked with a lot of. I hate to say, but my political leanings during that time that I was in college generally. Followed whichever girl I was dating at the time. If things would have worked out right, I would have become a Buddhist or a Christian or a Catholic. I didn't even take some kind of class to become a Catholic because I was dating a Catholic girl at that time.
Yeah, well, you were willing to get along. You just wanted to, you know, try to...
I wanted to experience everything, yes. Yes, I certainly did. And did you work right back, or you went to college then at that point?
I became a professional student, and I, you know, I was in and out of college basically until 1985 when I got a PhD. I got home in 1970, and 1985 I got a PhD in American history at the University of Washington, and took some time off in between that. I worked on boats for a while, and. But yeah, being in the Marine Corps enabled me to become and be a Vietnam veteran because in Washington State our tuition was frozen by Governor Evans, and so I think it was frozen at $280 a quarter.
Yeah,
and people won't believe that. And so as long as I stayed in Washington State, I could get GI Bill and pay $280 a quarter indefinitely.
Yeah, didn't you have a part-time job at the First and Last Chance Tavern too?
I was a bartender at the First.
Oh, that's a heaven job. That's a heaven job. That really is.
Well, yeah, I led a checkered career, but I eventually got a PhD.
So going to Vietnam allowed you to be a bartender when you came home then, is that correct?
Yeah, I had all kinds of opportunities.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of work in artillery around Ellensburg, Steve. You know, we didn't have too many artillery batteries, so I couldn't find a job.
Well, if I know you, you had probably dropped a few in the rodeo grounds there. So, you know, kind of get everybody excited. You got your PhD. When did you get your PhD?
In American history in 1985.
Okay. So, you know, you and I must have been, I was there a little bit later when I got mine at the University of Washington, but I was working for the Department of Education at that time, but and so, what have you learned about American? What did we learn about American history from the Vietnam War?
Well, nobody ever learns anything from history.
That's right.
We're supposed to study history so we can learn from the past, right?
That's right, and apply that towards the future.
Yeah.
Effectively is the key word there. And, I think that, I mean, do you think, let me ask you this, do you think the war in Vietnam was winnable?
Yeah.
Yeah, I do too.
First of all, let me say that I think that the Americans fighting communism was a good idea. And, you know, the communists have a lot of blood on their hands. Fortunately, there aren't many around anymore, but, you know, there still are, and they got a lot of blood on their hands. So I think fighting them was a good idea, but fighting them in Vietnam probably wasn't a good idea.
Right.
There were better places to fight them than Vietnam. And so, and I think that's what most of the Cold Warriors, you know, the Hawks, the State Department characters from the 40s and 50s, as they grew older, they said, you know, that wasn't the place to take a stand. It was a mistake.
Yeah, I think that I think there's a lot of truth in that, and I've also heard a lot of vets say, when I've talked to them on these interviews, is, you know, the war was winnable if it was fought by the army and not by the politicians.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, and that, you know, just even talking to, like, you know, Alan Aronica and some of those folks, that, you know, they're seeing, you know, you have a ceasefire, you're seeing, you know, 10 times the number of sand pens going up the river. What's the message here? Well, the message here is, you know, we probably obeyed pretty much by the ceasefire, but, you know, no one else really cared. And tell me about this. Do you think there was there must have been a culture of war in Vietnam. I mean, they've been in, you know, they've been in war ever since the Chinese, you know, and then France, and now United States. I mean, tell me about the culture of war.
They were stoic. They have a horrible history, and I think it's better now. I went back to Vietnam in 2000, incidentally. Me and Joel Smith went back, and you know, it was nice to see that the place is doing so much better now than it was. But they had gone through a horrible past.
Are you talking about jumping Joel Smith?
Yep. Yeah. He and I and a group of University of Washington. I taught at University of Washington Tacoma for 30 years.
Right. I knew you were down there for a long time.
And we took a group of students back in 2000. And yeah, I mean, capitalism had arrived, and you could look out from the hotel, look out over the Ho Chi Minh City, and see all these little splotches of color TV sets all over the place. And so, it was nice to see. It was nice to see things turned out better for the generations that followed the generation that was there when I was there.
And when I talked to Dave Watson, who lives there now, he was saying that, you know, like you said, that the Vietnamese were very good at recycling. And he was saying that he had tea in the building, you know, that was the U.S. Embassy, you know, where we have the iconic picture of the people climbing onto helicopters, you know, and that's...
Yeah, yeah.
And what he says, go ahead.
Did I just say Ho Chi Minh City?
Yes.
Okay. I meant Hanoi. I'm really sorry. But go back to Ho Chi Minh City and the American Embassy. They turned it into a tea house, you're saying?
Well, I guess in little office buildings and stuff, you know, probably a Subway and a McDonald's and a Starbucks.
Some of that old landscape and architecture is still around. You can see stuff that you remember, you know?
Yeah.
It's still there.
I've never really liked, you know, a Big Mac with fish sauce on it, but it just doesn't sound really tasty. But, but you know, he was saying also that, you know, the Vietnamese have been pretty resourceful in, you know, in opening up and getting people to come back there and visit. And, I guess the infrastructure leaves something to be desired with, you know, roads and stuff. Electricity is coming much better, and good health care.
Yeah, all that infrastructure was going in when I was there in 2000, and You know, so everything was torn up. All the roads were torn up, but it was definitely getting busy. And there was obviously a ton of capitalism going on. They were basically taxing the capitalists to support the welfare state.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and so, we're familiar with that.
That's progress. It's called progressivism.
That's right. That's right.
More power to them. They're doing, you know, they're doing better now than when we were there, because it was pretty grim situation, especially for civilians there. And the children, oh my gosh, kids growing up in that kind of an environment was just awful.
Well, and the Agent Orange, and still the unexploded ordnance, are still, you know, we're talking several generations down the road, and they're still having, you know, significant birth defects, that kind of thing. What would you, let me ask you just one final question. Are you glad you went? Are you glad that you participated in that? I mean, obviously, you know, you lived through it, and it's, you know.
I'm glad you asked that question.
Thank you, Mike.
I'm going to say something now. You're going to think, oh, geez, he's getting really off track here, but just follow me through. It'll take about 30 seconds.
Okay, that's about all we have, so go.
So Phil Everly and Don Everly brothers were in the Marine Corps Reserve at that time. They didn't go to Vietnam, but Don Everly once was asked if he's glad he was in the Marine Corps. And he said, I wouldn't do it again for $1 million, and I wouldn't trade the experience for $1 million. And so, we can end it with the Everly brothers then. I wouldn't do it again for $1 million. I wouldn't trade the experience for $1 million.
And our next hit is Wake Up Little Susie from the Everly Brothers.
Well, hey, do the transition, man.
That's right. Hey, good to see you. Good to talk to you, Mike. And I need to get over there now that I've got my vaccinations.
We're opening up.
Is the first and last chance opened up?
I don't. Are we on the air?
Yes, we are. Yes, we are.
Okay. It's open.
Oh, thank you, Jesus. Okay, and well, with that, we will let you go, and I will talk to you soon, Mike, and we'll email back and forth.
Yeah, you betcha.
Okay.
Thanks, Steve.
Take care. Bye bye.
To stream this or any other episode of Is Abled with Dr. Stephen W. Nurse, go to voiceofashon.org and look under the Shows tab.